Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm a host of New Books in Literary Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm delighted to speak today with Lukas Dittrich about his first book, Writing Across the Color Line, U.S. Print Culture and the Rise of Ethnic Literature, 1877-1920, published by University of Massachusetts Press in 2020. Lukas Dittrich is an adjunct professor of humanities at Lesley University, and a visiting lecturer of English at Framingham State University. He's also a council member and former president of the New England American Studies Association. His work combines interest in American literature, print culture, and critical ethnic studies. Hello, Lukas.
Hello.
Well, thank you for joining me today, and congratulations on your first book.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So your book discusses not only the development of ethnic literatures in the U.S. in the 19th century, but also how ethnic literature shaped the development of publishing venues, periodicals in particular. You start the book with the story of Zitkol Assay's publication in the Atlantic Monthly. Would you briefly describe how publication space for ethnic writers developed in the 19th century?
The book is certainly interested in that sort of push and pull between the authors and the publishers, right? So I've been interested in how, especially in the late 19th century, authors of color are starting to publish literary fiction and literary writing and to have it published in really mainstream venues like national publication venues and trade commercial publishing venues that had a national audience. And so, one thing that's happening in the mid-19th century is you'll have smaller ethnic publications pop up that are really growing out of the ethnic group. So you have like the Cherokee Phoenix or the Christian Recorder as these sort of examples of almost like niche publication within the ethnic community. And they have a very powerful voice and they're influential within that community. But they have trouble continuing to publish over long spans of time because they need funding for distribution and print publication. And so there are a lot of ethnic newspapers on the rise, especially toward the end of the century. But one of the shifts that my book is tracking is sort of what happens when multi-ethnic authors, authors of color, start to really target and to be accepted by commercial trade publishers. And so I'm looking at big, well-known publishers, and many of them are still around to this day, like Lippincott's, Houghton Mifflin, the Atlantic Monthly. You had mentioned that I sort of open with this anecdote about Zitkol Assay, and she's an American Indian writer, and she has a series of three autobiographical essays that get published in the Atlantic Monthly, and it's the first months of the 20th century. It's January 1900, February and March. And so this to me was like this interesting turn of the century moment where the Atlantic Monthly, as like the venue of literary publication, is saying, we want to recognize like an indigenous voice that's not being translated or described through an ethnographer, and to elevate it. And in some of their advertising materials at the time, they're putting her right at the front of the advertising materials. And yet, meanwhile, at the same time, you know, they were publishing serially this novel that was very exotic descriptions of American Indians. And even in those advertisements for Zitkala Shah, they're really exoticizing her as well, and like really playing up her like Indianness. And so there's this very fraught dynamic, and there's a lot of compromises at work when these authors enter these situations. And so I was interested in sort of what did they have to give up, or what type of compromises did they have to make to reach a national audience? And, you know, how was their work edited, or what similarities are there, you know, between the different writers, as they really start to say, you know, I can use literary writing to try to reach a big national American audience and readership.
So in your book, you describe the writers you analyze as ethnic writers or writers of color. And we already mentioned Zitkala Shah and in the previous question. But who are the other main characters of your project? What material did you use as the main source of analysis and investigation?
So the chapters do progress as a sort of series of case studies. So the first chapter after the introduction is focusing on Maria Amparo Ruiz de Burton. And she was, I would really describe her as a Californian writer, but she's, you know, she could also be described as a Mexican-American or Hispanic author who grew up in California at the time of the Mexican-American War. And she's really coming of age at the time of the Mexican-American War. And so she is seeing her nationality and her ethnicity shift within her own lifetime as that land is sort of absorbed into the United States. And she ends up marrying an American Army general, Henry S. Burton. And so that's why she gets this sort of hybrid last name, Maria Amparo Ruiz de Burton. And she published a play and two different novels, and these are sort of seen as the first sort of Mexican American novels in English, and in English is significant. And again, that goes back to trying to like target, you know, a national American audience or U.S. audience, I would say. The second chapter is looking at Charles W. Chestnut, and he is an African-American author who grows up in North Carolina, but sort of splits his time between North Carolina and Ohio. And his family migrates between the two as he's growing up, and they actually leave North Carolina during the Civil War. And then they return during Reconstruction. And then when Reconstruction is ending and segregation is on the rise, Chestnut decides to leave once again. And so there again, you have someone whose ethnic identity and sense of self is really deeply intertwined with these like historical shifts in like territory and within the United States. And he was a light-skinned African-American. His parents were free people of color. And he was sort of capable of passing as white, or would be perceived as white by many people, but he never took that on, and he always refused it, and insisted on identifying as an African American. In the third chapter, I'm looking at an Irish American journalist named Finley Peter Dunn, and he becomes almost like a control for the book project as a whole. To say, if we want to think about like white ethnic identity, like whether that would be like, you know, Jewish immigrants or Italian immigrants or Irish immigrants, then like how far do they go into this category of being persons of color? And we know that Irish Americans would have on their birth certificates they would be labeled as colored, and so he becomes a sort of test case of what happens with that white ethnic identity. And one thing that he is able to do is sort of walk that boundary a little bit, to that he's allowed to sort of have the whiteness, and he's also allowed to sort of criticize it. And then in the final chapter, I look at a Chicago publisher, really, that's A.C. McClurg, which is not to be confused with S.S. McClure, a publisher at the same time. But A.C. McClurg was a publisher in Chicago, and they published W.E.B. Du Bois, The Souls of Black Folk, and a couple of his other books. And they published Suisin Farr's Mrs. Spring Fragrance, which is one of the first Chinese American books of fiction in the United States. And so they, as a publisher, they also published some of the early Jewish American novels and fiction. And so one thing I sort of found there was that one of the editors at McClurg as a publishing house was interested in publishing multi-ethnic fiction. And there again, you get this sort of the hybridity of the authors, where Suisin Farr is this, she's Chinese American, but her father was an English merchant and who was sort of like a missionary into China. And then they migrated to Canada, and she herself lived all over North America. She lived in Jamaica, and she lived on the West Coast, and she lived in Boston. And her birth name was Edith Eaton, and she took on the name Suisin Farr. And her sister was also an author and took on a Japanese pen name. And so one thing I start to see in the sort of like multi-ethnic scope of the book is that there are these really strong comparisons to be made across ethnic boundaries when you have an author like Ruiz de Burton, who has this hybrid name, and then you have Edith Eaton Suisin Farr, and then you have Chestnut, who is perceived as white but refuses to pass. And even Finley Peter Dunn was born Peter Dunn, and he took on Finley as his mother's maiden name, and took it on almost as a sort of ethnic identifier to say, like, I really strongly identify with like the Irish aspect of my heritage. And how there's a sort of resistance to, being folded into whiteness there. And so that was something that interests me throughout, is how are these authors all in different positions, but they have to rely on similar strategies in order to sort of, again, to sort of approach a big audience and to have more of an impact with their work.
I really find this idea about hybrid names quite compelling, because on the one hand, it does imply this kind of gesture to incorporate some identities in your maybe writing persona, so to speak, if we can put it that way. On the other hand, it also communicates something about a language itself, that a language does contain this kind of, if we can even say images, right, how an identity can be constructed and an identity can be transmitted through the names which are included into actual names of the writers. I'm interested in those stories and narratives that ethnic writers offer, and how they different from what we usually describe as mainstream writers or well-published writers. How did these two narratives interact and overlap, shaping each other? You didn't mention that you cover some materials from very well-known publications or very well-known venues. And those venues were primarily for so to speak, mainstream writers. But what do writers of color or ethnic writers offer in terms of their narratives and how those narratives probably intervene with the narratives offered by mainstream writers?
Yeah, one thing that happens with a lot of the authors that I'm looking at is that they are almost doing a very subtle satire or parody of these sort of mainstream styles, and they realize that there was sort of this interest at the time in local, what's called local color or regionalist fiction. So alongside like realism and naturalism that's happening in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, there was a real interest in the different regions of the United States, like New England writers, Southern writers, Midwestern writers. And part of this is because the United States was growing and was becoming this global superpower. So there was this sense that they were like losing their regional identity. And so there was a sort of fascination with regional fiction that often involved like really heavy dialect being written into the fiction. And oftentimes it's really challenging for like a 21st century reader to go back and look at it. I sometimes say it would be almost like trying to read like text language for us now, is there was this big fad for like dialect and regional culture. And so one of the things that almost all of the authors I'm looking at do is they realize that all of these white authors are kind of taking our culture and writing it, and they're writing the dialect for us. And they say, well, like, I can do that, but I can have like a different message, right? I could sort of be giving a different message than they're giving. So one example would be with Charles Chestnut, that he writes his first book that he publishes called The Conjure Woman in 1899. It's a sort of thinly veiled parody of Joel Chandler Harris's Uncle Remus stories. And these Uncle Remus stories were essentially the Brer Rabbit stories that we still have in like Disney's Song of the South. And, but these were the Brer Rabbit folk tales about this like tricky rabbit who could kind of escape any sort of trouble that he was into. And that was a real folktale within the African-American community that Joel Chandler Harris had sort of taken, appropriated, repackaged, and he was selling it. And it was hugely, hugely popular. And one thing about those stories is that they're being told, the folktales themselves within the fiction is being told by a formerly enslaved person, like a freedman. And so this freedman narrator is telling these stories about like the old South and the antebellum plantation. And he's telling these stories about this animal character, Brer Rabbit, who no matter how much trouble he's in, he can always escape. He can always get out of it. And the main tone of those stories is that the old South was not that bad, that the plantation was like a big happy family, and everyone was happy to be there and to get along with each other. And what Chestnut does is he takes that style, and he has a freedman narrator who's telling these stories of the old South. And so he takes that style and the dialect fiction, and the content, the message is much more tragic, much more serious. And so when he has stories, he has one character who's an enslaved character who's trying to be reunited with his wife. They've been separated on the plantation, and he tries to hide, and he gets sort of turned into a tree. It's like this magical power that allows him to turn into a tree so that he can escape and meet with his wife. And then the tree ends up being cut down and it's milled into lumber. And so this is just one of the stories with Chestnut stories. Another person like gets turned into the vines. Some of the other characters are eating dirt. And, you know, one of the characters is steals a ham from the plantation owner, the slave master, the enslaver, and is forced to like wear the ham, like it's chained to his neck. And so it's very, you know, there's a very sort of dark content here that is saying that, you know, is really commenting on how terrible slavery was. And, you know, with the bodies being turned into like the raw material of racial capitalism. And, but the incredible thing is that Houghton Mifflin had published, Joel Chandler Harris and Uncle Remus. They were the publishers of the Uncle Remus stories, and Chestnut managed to get them to publish his stories and to package them the same way. And so readers would have bought these books from the same publisher with a similar cover. And the readers, a lot of the evidence shows that the readers didn't necessarily notice the difference, or that some readers could and some readers wouldn't. And so that becomes another thing for the authors to negotiate, is to consider, if no readers are getting this, then do I keep doing it? And is this making any type of difference? And that was one of the questions that really drove my project, was a lot of other scholarly critics were aware that ethnic authors at the time were making this kind of subversive satirical maneuver. And what I really wanted to know with my research was, were the editors aware? Was the audience aware? Like, how was this marketed? How popular was it? What impact did it have? And so that was kind of where a lot of my research intervened in the more like scholarly conversation.
Well, earlier you mentioned that you were also interested in how much the ethnic writers had to compromise in order to be published. So that's my that's one question. And another one is about editors. To what extent were these works edited? And if you had a chance to trace those changes or edits, what they can reveal about those emphases that the editors wanted to include in these publications?
Yeah. So, I mean, with, you know, to go back to Chestnut just very quickly with this, but he had wanted to publish like a more contemporary novel about a mixed race protagonist, and to have it be a little bit more openly political. And he had pitched that to Houghton Mifflin in like the early 1890s. And they said, you know, we don't really like this, and we think you need to keep writing for a bit and publish more stories before you're really ready to be a Houghton Mifflin author. And then when they came back to him and they wanted a book, they wanted his Conjure stories. They wanted like the Uncle Remus stories. And so he made the decision, and he said right away, like, yeah, I'd be happy to publish that. So he made the decision as an author to say, I will do more of those style of stories. And he wrote a number of those stories very quickly to fill out the book collection, right? He had some of them published in magazines, but he wrote more of them to like answer the editor's sort of proposal for the book. And then one thing he did was, once that book was published and he was in as like a Houghton Mifflin author, then he publishes another book of short stories that's sort of pushing the envelope. And he publishes his third book with Houghton Mifflin is the novel that he had originally pitched to them. And so he kind of uses that as an in, and he kind of, you know, leverages it to go more in the direction that he wants to go. And so his authorial, his style as an author and his techniques are evolving. You know, the editors, they always know, they are always aware that the texts are critical. Like the Houghton Mifflin editor, It wouldn't have been that he was not aware that it was a parody. Like, he understood that it was a parody, and he was sort of in on it. You know, but it wasn't really as successful as they hoped, as this criticism. Other edit, like, W.E.B. Du Bois, when he's working on The Souls of Black Folk, I mean, he's essentially already famous. He's a Harvard graduate. He's already published in The Atlantic and in all sorts of periodicals. And his editors at A.C. McClurg, they try to make a couple of adjustments. They want him to tone back on the language in a few spots. And he refuses. He says, no, I want to keep it. And there are letters between Du Bois and his editor, Francis Granger Brown at A.C. McClurg. And Brown says, I tried to tone back on this passage where you talk about the Philippines and you're talking about Puerto Rico. And basically, it's a comment on U.S. imperialism as we like expand, as the nation expanded into Hawaii and into the Philippines. But if you go into the book, the passage is there. It's still there. And so Du Bois insisted that it stayed and it was allowed to stay. But then again, meanwhile, with Suisun Farr, who's also writing with McClurg, she's lesser known and she's a woman author and she's a journalist. She does a lot of periodical writing. And so she had wanted to publish a novel that is lost, and they refused the novel, or it's kind of unknown what happens to the novel exactly. And they asked her to publish short stories. And there's a scholar at University of Connecticut, Martha Cutter, who does a really great article about her interactions with editors and how the editors always say they like her little stories, and she was herself petite, and so they sort of say, like, we want you to do a collection of your little stories and we're not sure you're like a big author for a novel. And so there was this way where a lot of women writers get sort of put into the realm of periodicals and doing short journalism and short journalistic pieces. And she made her career as like a freelance writer and a stenographer. And so she got one book together, but she wasn't really entirely in control of what they were, what they were asking for when they requested it. So it depends. It depends on who the author is and what the situation is. But, one of my findings was that the editors and the publishers were surprisingly supportive. They were more aware of the satire and the subversive qualities. And when they decided to say yes to an author, they did a pretty good job marketing it. They didn't really like overpower the text in the editorial process. They might like cut off the relationship abruptly and end it, but when they're working with the authors, when they make that decision, they do a quite a good job with it. And really what ends up limiting that relationship is the readership and the audience. So when the book doesn't sell, or it gets critically panned, or it bombs, and that's one of the things that keeps happening. And I think it's actually a good way to think about what's happening with the sort of multi-ethnic literature in general at this era, like the 1890s, early 1900s, is that the editors see this potential and they see that American culture is kind of moving in this direction. So they're trying to support it, but the readership is sort of actually rejecting it. And so then it sort of doesn't like reemerge until later on in the 20th century.
So you primarily focus on 1877, 1920. Any specific reason why this time period, and how does this time period differ from, 1930, 1950s? I imagine the difference is crucial, but still, why 1977, 1920?
Well, yeah, so 1877 is like kind of the marker of the end of Reconstruction. And so you're kind of coming out of Reconstruction toward the turn of the century, and you know, you're starting to see like the rise of segregation after Reconstruction. Again, I was kind of went into the project being interested in this being this era where the U.S. is sort of on the rise as like a global superpower, and like what's happening in the culture leading up to that. You know, I think that there are these interesting questions of periodizing any type of like literature and saying when is early or late. And there were kind of these questions about like what is early African American literature. Mm-hmm. And you know, you have writers that just go all the way back, right? And that's one thing I was trying to be careful with, to say, you know, you always have African American writers. So, you know, one way to isolate like the dynamic that I'm looking at is to say, I was really interested in what happens when they start to be published by mainstream trade commercial publishers. And so that's really happening in this era. And it really is not until the late 19th century that you start to see that. And part of that too is that the trade publishing itself is evolving, right? So in order to have like a national distribution, I mean, you need to have like national railroads and transportation. And so, you know, America is like expanding as a territory to the West Coast and into the 1890s. And so there's also this kind of like solidification of the US's national boundaries in this era, where the map that we know as like the continental 48 states and then then Hawaii and Alaska, that's taking shape at this time. And so the US is kind of like solidifying its borders and meanwhile taking in massive waves of immigrants, right? So the Immigration Act, the major Immigration Act in the United States, is 1924. And so throughout this period, there are just massive waves of immigrants coming in and changing population dynamics. And so on the tail end of my project is when they say, we need to change the way this immigration process is working. And of course, I should say that there are, you know, the one exception to that, the one major exception to that, is the Chinese Exclusion Acts and anti-Chinese immigrant acts, which date back to the 1880s. So I think, you know, for me, there's these like large historical processes happening where the nation is kind of taking shape, like a modern U.S. in the way that we know it. And then also that the publishing of American writers of color in terms of like literary fiction or literary quality writing is happening at this time. And I think that, you know, part of with the 1920s and ending the project in 1920 is, you know, by the time World War I ends and by the time you start to see the rise of like the Harlem Renaissance in 1919, is there is this sort of like crossover happening in the 1920s where white readers become much more interested in like African American writing, and authors do too as well. And so like the authors, like major white authors, start mimicking the tactics of the writers of color. This is sort of like the dialect of modernism idea. But so for me, by the 1920s, like the crossover is starting to really happen. And so to me, this was kind of this in-between period. Things were really changing and shifting. And there was this like sort of crossover that was happening. And so, you know, I think that the dates, like dating it exactly, is always a little bit an abstract process. But for me, it's happening in those decades surrounding the turn of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. I would like to talk a little bit more about readers' expectations. You did mention already something about how readers to some extent shaped what was published. But how did ethnic writers shape the American readership?
Mm. Yeah, the reading process and the reception aspect is it's so challenging to get a grasp on or get a handle on, because reading is just such a mysterious process in general. And so you have, you know, evidence of reading is so tricky. Like, you have published reviews, and then you could have someone could write a memoir and they could like talk about their reading experience. And you have sales, you have how many books were bought, or you could have like library records. But trying to get a gauge on readership is a really challenging thing. And, you know, there are all these interesting examples in like scholarship on reception of when readers are doing things that are not what's expected of them. That's always kind of interesting, is when a reader interprets a book a way that they're like not supposed to. And oftentimes that's a really like positive relationship, is when people, a lot of times the reader gets sort of glorified for being able to do anything they want with the text. And for me, one of the things I kept finding was like the reader was shutting this down. Like the readers were just, white readers were like not ready to hear these authors. And so part of what I'm outlining is there's this dynamic where the readers, if there's this subversive quality to this literature, or there's a parody or a satire there, the readers often, they just don't see it, right? They're just kind of like, they're not aware of it. They're not ready to recognize it. Or if they do recognize it, then they become very critical, and they sort of have this like harsh backlash, and they start to say, this isn't even literature, right? If it's political, it's not literature. And so that's this sort of like, there's this sort of double vision that the predominantly white, like sort of mainstream audience has that reacts to this fiction. But like at the same time, these books, they're distributed all over the country, right? And some of them, it may be like 600 copies, 800 copies. Some of them are getting 4,000 or 5,000 copies. Du Bois, Souls of Black Folk, is like 30,000, and then it moves into 60,000 by like the mid 20th century. So they're getting distributed, and they're getting produced in quality volumes, quality books that are going to survive, right? So it's not a local niche publication. It's like a really quality book that's being distributed very widely and that survives. And so one of the sort of amazing things you start to see is that these later generations of authors become so influenced. And so I think that is one of the really like more hopeful things to take away, is the way that certain audiences are there, and sometimes they're not there at the same time, right? So when you get into the Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s, they're all looking back to Du Bois and looking back to Chestnut. And, Finley Peter Dunne, this Irish-American author, I mean, he is actually very popular at the time, but he influences Langston Hughes, and he influences Fus Fixico. And so he's having an influence on these other ethnic writers that are doing this like sort of political satire in the same style. And so you start to see all of these influences popping up later on. And I think that was really interesting to me, was that even while the predominant reaction was to criticize and sort of shut down this writing, that the authors and the publishers together, by like producing these books and distributing them, they have this much more long-term impact. And that impact is very real and is sort of experimental, sort of foundational for like a lot of the changes we see happening, more into the mid 20th century.
Mm-hmm. So Would you talk a little bit about Bret Hart's poem, Plain Language from Truthful James, and about how it was perceived and understood? I found this story particularly fascinating.
Oh, yeah. So this is, I think this story is like, this is, a few people have talked about this. So this wasn't my own original scholarship to know about this story, but Bret Hart, sort of another sort of Californian writer, and he writes this poem called Plain Language from Truthful James. And it's about a card game. Some characters are playing poker out west. And what happens is that the narrator of the poem, who is like Truthful James, he and his friend they're cheating. They have extra Bowers, which is like a jack in the game that they're playing, and they're cheating. And then when they mistakenly like both lay down the same card, which should not be in the deck twice. And when they get caught for that, they blame a Chinese immigrant player at the table, and they attack him and kick him out and say that he is cheating. And so the poem was meant to be a criticism of the sort of white narrator. And the title of the poem, Plain Language from Truthful James, is again this sort of like satire, this sort of subversion where this is not plain language, he is not truthful. But what happened with the reception and the reading of the poem was that throughout the poem, they use derogatory language against the Chinese person who they're trying to accuse of cheating. And they say he's the heathen Chinese whose ways are dark. And so this like racist language is then taken up by anti-immigrant, like know-nothing activists. And so all of these people who are very anti-Chinese immigrant, they use the language of the poem, and it becomes this like slogan for them to say Chinese immigrants should not be allowed in the country, is that these are heathen Chinese, their ways are dark. And so you have this misreading of the poem and a misreading of its subversion. And then it becomes extremely popular for something that is completely against Bret Hart's intent. And he himself acknowledged, he said, I wish I hadn't even written it, if I had known it was going to be taken up in this way. And again, that became a sort of very interesting example for me, because a lot of people had known about the body of literature that I'm talking about, and that writers of color were taking on these regionalist styles and sort of satirizing them and criticizing them by using them and reappropriating them. And so a lot of the criticism, the scholarly criticism that I was reading going into this was saying, well, look at how brilliant this is. Look at how subversive this is. And so one of my questions became like, did anyone know that? Did anyone understand it, right? Or were people just misreading it in the same way that the plain language from Truthful James was being misread? And so again, I kind of wanted to go see, like, were the editors aware? Were the readers aware? And kind of digging around for any type of clues about how the text was actually being understood and whether it was really accomplishing the goals that I think we can sort of say the authors had certain goals, right? You can't say exactly what their intentions were, but we know that Chestnut was trying to do something very different from Joel Chandler Harris with Br'er Rabbit. And so, did readers pick up on that or not? And a lot of times I'm encountering the same dynamic as the Bret Hart poem where, it doesn't seem like they really did. It doesn't seem like they really did understand it.
So you did describe some influences of ethnic writers on the writers from the 20th century, for example. But would you offer any kind of comment on the influence, ethnic writers from the 19th century on the ethnic writers or writers of color in the 21st century?
You're saying from them into the 21st century?
21st century, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of this work was has been sort of recovered, right? There's this term for like recovery, which is not that the, you know, not to say discovery, but to say that, you know, Charles Chestnut was relatively known in the early 1900s, and then he was not very well known for a long time. And, you know, in the 1990s and into the past 30 years, he's becoming more well known, you know, especially within scholarly circles. Like, he gets taught in college. And so there's this sort of recovery of these writers, and almost all of the authors I'm looking at have been sort of recovered in this way. So, Maria Amparo Ruiz de Burton gets recovered in the 1990s as this example of early Mexican American fiction. Chestnut gets recovered as this like sort of pre-Harlem Renaissance, like proto, very high literary fiction. And then Sui Sin Phar has been recovered. And so her work was not really directly influential. Like, you know, the Asian American literary tradition, you know, follows a different path with the sort of immigration laws as well. Min Song, a professor at Boston College, has a good book about this and about how when the immigration restrictions change in the 1960s, you get this sort of new generation of writers. And so, you know, it's tough to say. I don't think those writers in the 60s, 70s were looking back to Sui Sin Phar. But again, her work is getting recovered in the late 1980s, 1990s. And so, you know, that was the era that was sort of called the Canon Wars, right? Is there was this, there were these arguments among academics to say, we need to listen to these voices that are not strictly Moby Dick or Nathaniel Hawthorne or Shakespeare, and to say we need to open up and we need to actively think about if there are authors that are being excluded from the sort of you know, canon, then, you know, who are they and what type of value does their work have to offer? And so for me, it was interesting because, like, I as an undergrad was being taught this literature. Like, I was taught Chestnut in an American literature survey, and then I was taught him again during my master's degree. Like, he was on the syllabus. And so I had sort of always been interested in that through coursework and course reading. And so to me, I'm sort of like following in my own like career trajectory, I'm like following like, in the wake of that recovery, is I don't really have to make the case, you know, maybe a little bit I do, but I don't really have to make the case for why we value this writing. I think like that case has been made. And if you want to disagree with it, then I'm like not really going to pick up there. But I can sort of take the fact that a lot of people agree that there's value in this literature. And then I can say, well, I want to do some more detailed scholarship on it. Because, I mean, like, you know, with the book history aspect of what I'm doing and like digging into the textual production and the reception, you know, if you try to do that on Moby Dick or Nathaniel Hawthorne, like, there's so many sources that are doing this like textual work of what was the relationship like with the editor. And so I went to look at W.E.B. Du Bois' Souls of Black Folk, like one of the most well-known canonical African-American texts of the 20th century. And almost all of the scholars had gotten they didn't know who the editor was. They had misnamed the editor as his father. And there were two editions of the Souls of Black Folk early on. There was like a first printing, and then Du Bois had wanted to make changes before the second printing because he noticed that things in the introduction and the final chapter that he hadn't seen the proof copies. And so it was kind of incredible to me that some of those basic textual elements of like what edition are we looking at, which are, they're so well established for these canonical authors, that I could like almost stumble upon pretty significant aspects of like textual production that were not known about the souls of Black folk. Like I couldn't really believe that I was the one seeing that, because to me that it's such an important work. And but again, I think it just relates to the fact that it's really not until the past 20, 30 years that people in the academic world are really starting to pay attention to these records.
So do you have a chance to teach this material to your students? And if yes, what's their response?
So I've taught surveys of American literature where this ends up being like 1 week or like a week and a half. And so that's kind of an interesting situation to be in, because oftentimes with the survey that I'm teaching, I'm trying to cover this range, like 150 years in 15 weeks. And so it's always kind of interesting to say to the students in that course that like this material here that occupies this small section of the course, this is what I wrote my entire book on, and this is what I'm an expert in. I've had students who are, I think with some of the dialect, it's really challenging. The dialect is kind of off-putting to readers. You kind of have to struggle through it. Mm-hmm. And that would be in a good portion of the Chestnut. It's all of the Finley Peter Dunn. So I try to steer clear of that, and I try to recommend or assign students some of the work that is not so thick with dialect. And so if people are asking for recommendations from the book, then I say I recommend Chestnut's The Wife of His Youth or The House Behind the Cedars. And those are very readable. And Zikalasha, the stories that I open with, American Indian stories, those are very readable. And the students can, with her work, it's these autobiographical essays, so the students can relate. It's sort of this very short essay coming of age story. And it's also sort of brings in and plays on some like Western religious elements. Like there are these apples as she's being taken away, and it's almost like this Garden of Eden scene. So one thing I've done when I've tried to teach it is I try to, or if I ever recommend texts that I'm looking at, is I say, maybe don't go straight into the dialect, but maybe look at some of those other ones that I think are a little bit more readable and a little bit more accessible.
So I understand probably after you publish your first book, you would like to take a break, but do you have any current projects, or do you have any projects in mind that you would like to work on?
Well, I'm actually thinking about going backwards in time rather than forward, and going back more into the mid 19th century. And, I'm trying to keep an open mind right now, because I'm reading a lot of like secondary criticism and scholarly criticism. And another thing that's kind of nice for me personally is right now I live, between Boston and Worcester. And so, I'm trying to, it's not really happening right now during the pandemic, but I have access to a lot of the libraries that are here and to the Antiquarian Society. And so I think, right now I'm trying to keep the ideas and the creative process going with that, as I think about like what archives can I use to get more into a second project. But I have been leaning towards moving back earlier into the 1800s. And what I'm seeing a lot of people do that is really fascinating is you know, for me to shift outside of that mainstream national trade and to think about, you know, is there some of that niche publication where I could look into that and dig up some history that is just sort of not necessarily known, mm-hmm. right? It's like really seeing a lot in like Derek Spires, The Practice of Citizenship, the Colored Conventions Project, where they're saying like there's all this history that really still needs to be recovered. And so I'm trying to look for what would be a space for me to say, I'm going to try to recover some of that history. And I want to make sure that I'm not, that I'm doing something a little bit new or finding something that, you know, not someone else is looking at right now. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of where I'm at with that. I'm not fully decided, but that's sort of the direction I see myself going.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you good luck. And let's hope that the current situation will change soon, because this statement, well, I can't do much really at this moment, is some sort of a theme right now. Well, thank you so much, Lucas. Thank you so much for your research and for your book that contributes to our understanding of the rise of ethnic literature in American literature. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Natalia. It was good talking with you.
Today, I spoke with Lucas Dittrich about his book, Writing Across the Color Line, U.S. Print Culture and the Rise of Ethnic Literature, 1877-1920, published by University of Massachusetts Press in 2020. Thank you for listening to New Books in Literary Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.